Spartacus Blood and Tits. That's the name of my new mummy makeover plastic surgery salon in suburban Arizona. Hello and welcome to Master of Our Domain, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld, but is now currently about Spartacus Blood and Sand, a show which will CGI fucking anything. My name is Milo Edwards, and I'm joined, as ever, by my intrepid co-hosts, Patrick Wyman and Phoebe Roy. How are we doing?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. You know, it's been a week.
Yeah, once again, you, the listener, have missed out on the gossip portion of the podcast. The trauma bonding section of the podcast.
We like to keep that every good podcast is an iceberg in which the productive conversation is buried and you're just seeing the very tip. Yeah. Just seeing the very tip poking out through your earbuds there.
Sign up to the $100 a month tier on the Patreon to get the preambles.
Yeah, if you'd like to hear about my mother and her escapades, then that's the tier for you.
Yeah, that's it. Sign up to the MILF tier of the Patreon to get all of your mother-related updates and news.
Oh, man. That's... Oof. You just said MILF and right immediately after my mother came up, and that's... Oof, buddy. Oh, man. That's...
It's tough. Everyone likes MILFs, but no one wants it to be their own mum, you know?
Yeah.
We want there to be a supply of MILFs, but we never want to be the ones to supply them.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. Phoebe, thoughts?
We never want to be the ones to supply them. Is that... I'm not sure this is the right verb.
What do we mean by supply here?
Because I think that if we're talking about the issuing and distribution mechanism of MILFs, I don't think that economic burden should rest on their children. I don't think you could say that a child supplies a MILF. Whether they are an adult child or not.
Are you brokering the MILF if your mum's a MILF?
I think a child creates the conditions by which the MILF can be produced.
Mm. Yeah, so child is a marker of MILF status?
Yeah, exactly. Like so the child is the viticulturalist. But they're not the vine.
Kids don't want to take their shoes off and stamp on their mum anymore in a big bucket.
I'm loving the idea of MILF. MILF is the product of intense viticulture. God damn it.
Kids don't want to macerate their mother and age her in an oak barrel for 10 to 15 years anymore.
That's the death of filial piety for you.
Yeah. Yeah, people only have the patience to produce Lambrini MILFs now. Light sparkling whites. It's all people have the patience for.
Taking a big sniff and being like, you know what? I feel like there wasn't enough rain that year. This is not a good year.
It's a dry MILF.
It's a dry MILF year.
Yeah.
I mean, my year was an excellent year for MILFs.
Yeah. Strong vintage.
Yeah. Well, it's the soil density in the area where you grew up, you know?
Yeah.
Mm. Written in the stars.
Exactly.
Even.
Yeah.
Lambrini is not a wine though, right? Isn't it Lambrini a Peri of some description?
Lambrini, I believe, is it's a type of Lambrusco, which is like a sparkling white, but it's like Spritzer.
So what am I thinking of? I know that's not helpful. I know that's not the most
helpful. You might be thinking of Lambrini because it is basically lemonade.
No, but there is something which is technically a Peri.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What do you mean by Peri? Like Perrier?
No, Peri is a cider, but it's made of pears rather than apples. Lambrini is a Peri.
Oh, is it? Oh,
yeah, it is. God, I'm proud of my increasingly esoteric knowledge.
Give it to me straight like a pear cider.
this is the segment of the show where I hope nobody notices that I don't know anything about wine, sparkling wine. I know a lot about sparkling whites, but that's a racial thing and not a not a wine thing.
Oh, mate. Don't worry, no, my degree is in race science. I know very little about viticulture.
Yeah. No, so,
what do you determine to be the sparkling whites? We're talking the Greeks, the Italians? Is that the...
Oh, no. I was thinking more like West Hollywood. Oh, that's a sparkling white.
Yeah, I see.
Anyone who's got the turkey teeth.
I see.
Veneers. Yeah. Mm. Like there's a lot of different ways to be a sparkling white, if we're being honest.
Is this a bonus episode, Mike?
Yes.
Okay. You can leave that in. I think if it was a free, I would probably request.
Well, for racism against white
people. Removal
of
the Greeks and Italians as sparkling white.
Oh, I see. Sparkling white boy summer. How about that?
Sparkling white boy summer.
They're an effervescent people.
Yeah. So, you know what? That's gone. Whatever it was I was going to say, that's just completely gone. I'm just thinking about
there were so many of Phoebe's racial theories about Greeks and Italians trying to get out the door of her mind there that they caused a kind of stampede and then all knocked each other out.
Yeah, Mr. Burns and the Diseases.
Yeah,
that's Phoebe's racial theories about Southern Europe.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know why I'm agreeing to this. You know what? No, those are not my racial theories about Southern Europe. I have no racial theories about Southern.
My racial theories about Southern Europe are clear and unified, and that would not happen were I to voice them.
They're very clearly written down in this notebook.
I lent someone my recipe notebook. And then, like, and now to add to my racial theories notebook, and then you open it and it's like spaghetti pomodoro. You're like,
oh no, oh no.
It's got a lot of Italian in there, but it's.
No, but that is not what we were talking about.
My,
that is
my
not
Harriet
what
the
that
spy
notebook
moment.
Was referring to. Yeah. Oh my God.
Should we talk about Spartacus?
Yeah, let's talk about Spartacus.
Speaking of sparkling whites, or rather maybe glistening whites.
Yeah.
A lot of glistening whites.
And also a MILF of a very fine vintage.
Yeah.
Oh,
the opening sequence of this episode.
Yeah.
Are they supposed to be like in space or something? Because it's fucking mad. Like the amount of CGI in the opening scene where it's like fucking John Hannah talking to Spartacus. And it's just like the background is like it's fully like zoom background of space. Like I don't understand like what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah. There's
I was like, is this a dream sequence? Like I don't understand.
Okay. So while I generally appreciate the kind of surreal visual language of this show, there are also points, and that was one of them, where just because you can stick something in doesn't mean you should. That was one of them. It's like, we could have just had a wall. It could have just been a wall. They've just been standing in front of a wall.
Yeah, they must have had access to a wall.
Didn't need to happen.
There must have been a wall behind them when they were shooting.
I assume that that they were in some kind of at least partially enclosed space.
Yeah.
Could have left that in. Yeah.
Yeah.
I still don't think it was in space.
Well, I don't think they shot it in space. No.
That would be quite a departure.
But can you honestly think back on that scene and say they weren't in space? Because if you can't make that determination immediately, I think we've got a problem.
Well, I mean, I don't want to do any spoilers, but we do find out at the end of the series that that it's actually on a completely different planet. And if you kind of pan out from Capua, then it's all monkeys.
The old reverse planet of the apes.
So this is a bit of a visual cue that sooner or later you are going to see a planet inhabited entirely by monkeys.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm in. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are we but hairless monkeys?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. But these are
proper we're the monkeys. Hairless monkeys, and this is Radio 1's Big Weekend.
I just realized I was edging extraordinarily close to Joe Rogan with that whole hairless monkeys thing, and I'm I'd like to offer my deepest apologies.
Joe Rogan should do the backgrounds from this show for his podcast.
So I can guarantee you that Joe Rogan has watched this show.
Oh, yeah.
I can also guarantee you that everything about this show that actually makes it worth watching went right over his head. Completely over.
Well, he would have got completely fixated on the man who cuts people's faces off because he's like, oh, yeah. I spotted the monkey. I spotted the monkey.
Mm-hmm. Mm. He would love that guy.
He would love that guy. So I'm not that keen on that guy. I think he's got a bad attitude. I don't know what his problem is. Like, what the fuck? Why are you doing that, man?
Nobody said to him as a child that he was enough.
Yeah.
Nobody told that boy that it was okay to just be him. Yeah. He always knew he had to perform for other people.
Yeah.
He had to do things to be acceptable to them. And that's in, you know, if you go down that path long enough, if you don't deal with your unresolved childhood trauma, you end up cutting people's faces off in a pit for money.
This is the difference between authoritarian and authoritative parenting. You know, one produces well-rounded, independent, securely attached adults, and the other produces someone who cuts people's faces off and then puts them on his face. I think that's the bit that strikes me as so particularly unnecessary. Because, like, it's one thing to kind of cut someone's face off when you've defeated them. Like, fine, it's, you know, it demonstrates dominance, and it also demonstrates to the watching all powerful monkeys.
You're practicing for Spartacus Blood and Tits, the plastic surgery clinic that you're going to open for Roman Mills.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a Nip Tuck spinoff.
Yeah, for Spartacus Nip Tuck, which is honestly, like, the reason that Spartacus Nip Tuck like never took off is because nobody wants to see somebody getting liposuction while suspended from a crucifix. It's just horrible. No one needs to see that. No one wants to see that. No one wants to see like a surgeon like commenting on what John Hannah has like had done. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to hear someone saying like, oh, this is, you know, this is very subtle buckle fat removal. Yeah. That John
That's what people don't know about Jesus's crucifixion, is it was actually just botched plastic surgery. It was a diet craze that went wrong.
Yeah. Ozempic hadn't worked. He knew he needed something stronger.
Yeah. And
next thing you know, founder of a major religion.
I mean, it's kind of like a detox in a way. You're up on a cross for 3 days.
I mean, that will clean you out one way or the other.
It's great for your core strength.
Great for your core strength.
That's why Jesus always looks like he's got just incredible abs. Always.
Yeah.
That will be
shredded.
That will be why. That will be why. Mm.
That's the Jesus wad in CrossFit, where they just hang you up on a cross for 3 days.
And somehow, even with the nails, that would do less damage to your body than your average CrossFit workout.
That's why it's called CrossFit. Because they put
you. Yeah, exactly.
Because they just stick you up on them.
So I don't know if you guys are all that familiar with CrossFit culture, but there are a lot of very like hardcore dedicated Christians who are very into CrossFit.
Great.
And I guarantee you that we are not the first people to make the CrossFit connection.
Evangelical Christians just joining some kind of cult.
Like, you show up at your CrossFit box, and you just got to be really careful about which room you go in. You know what? We've actually made this exact joke before. With the Pontius Pilates bit that we did before. It's the same joke. And what I like to think of this as, it means that we have got a kind of unity of theme, purpose, unity of cultural expression, rather than we just make the same jokes over and over.
It's all emanating from the same semantic space.
Exactly. Yeah. So my problem with the guy with the thing in the pit is not the face seizing in itself, because like I said, you have to demonstrate to the monkeys that your instincts are theirs. So a monkey defeats you in battle, they're going to snatch your face off. So you want to indicate to the monkey that you understand, you sympathize, you empathize with their desire to snatch the face off. What I can't get behind is the putting the face on yourself. Why is that part of it? Why, like at what point in your kind of like horrible human kombucha that you have created Like, why are you looking at that and being like, you know what? I want to put that on my face. It must smell horrible.
Can't be good.
No.
I mean, I don't know that it's been properly cured or treated. Or
and also, how are the different leaves stuck together? Like, what if, like, one falls off? That's embarrassing. Imagine you're, like, you're cutting around with your 10-face thick mask on, and, like, one of the faces just kind of, like, peels off and just whop.
I mean, a lot of questions about structural integrity.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's sort of like a kind of macabre pass the parcel. Like, you know, you keep peeling faces off and you're like, oh, no, it's still not the real him. Or is it kind of like the gladiatorial equivalent of the Masked Singer? Like, he comes out swinging his sword and then people are like, I think that's Alan Johnson. Something about the way he's swinging that gladius really reminds me of former Health Secretary Alan Johnson.
So I have a take on this guy and on the pit as a whole. Mm-hmm. And it raises a question for me with this show as to whether the people making it were trying to bring this stuff out because of the ways in which it reflects something about Roman society, mm-hmm. or whether they just did it because they thought it'd be cool and accidentally shed some deep light on Roman society. And I can't always tell. I think it's probably a little bit of both in this, but the pit and the way, because it would be possible to just put that in and have it be just kind of a shocking thing. Like it's a literal descent into hell. It serves a really distinct narrative purpose in the structure of the show, right? Mm. Like if you always have somewhere in the middle of a story, you've got to have a descent into the underworld, literal or metaphorical. Mm-hmm. But the way that they've done it here actually hits very closely to Roman concerns about blood sport and the way that they talk about them, the way that, like, having Varro, the other gladiator, having been a better in the pits and talking about what that did to him and the way that made him feel, like, they've handled that with a level of insight that makes me think they're actually trying to do it. Mm-hmm. Because the most famous critique of Roman blood sport comes from quite late in antiquity. It comes from Saint Augustine, a Christian theologian, doctor of the church, author of City of God, The Confessions, one of the most influential figures in kind of late antique Christian history.
Huge freak, real nasty pervert. Like Saint Augustine wouldn't wear a mask made of your face, but like, he'd think about it.
He would think about what he would do sexually with
the mask.
Like there, like he had a lot of thoughts.
He's got some stuff going on. Like, I think if St. Augustine had a better editor, they might have left him some notes. Like, maybe this one is for your journal, pal.
Which the confession. Yeah, we get into a lot of stuff in there.
Too much of a confession. Maybe we could dial back the confession aspects.
Yeah,
it was a self-publishing culture. You know, he was the equivalent of those guys who write dinosaur erotica and sell it on Amazon Kindle.
Freud had a field day with Augustine. I put it that way.
And you know when Freud is calling you a freak.
the guy who loved to talk about cocaine and fucking thought you had a problem. Maybe you may actually have been in trouble. But one of the lesser commented on aspects of Augustine's work is that he talks a lot about blood sport. Like he has a substantial section where he talks about going to the arena and watching the fights and what that does to you psychologically as a member of the crowd, mm-hmm. and the way that makes you feel. And I think it's the most insightful thing that we have from antiquity, talking about the experience of being an observer of the games. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, and it resonated with me when I read it, because I was covering combat sports at the time. I was covering professionally, like guys fighting each other for money in front of a crowd. And so I was thinking a lot about crowd psychology and what are the observers getting out of this? And Augustine talks, I think, quite movingly about what it means to watch that kind of stuff, what it does to you as an observer of it, and the ways in which that brings out kind of the worst parts of your soul. Mm-hmm. And he talks about a friend of his who was just addicted to it, that like he couldn't get enough of the kind of energy that's going around the games. He couldn't get enough of the bloodlust. And I think that's it. They have kind of backed their way into that exact dynamic here. And to some extent, these are human universals, but the specificity with which they do it makes me think that somebody who was involved in the making of this show was familiar with that. I don't know who it was, but the kind of sensitivity with which they handle that dynamic and from all of the perspectives, because we see all of the different people who are involved in this and their incentives and their reactions. And there are a lot of crowd shots of people and how they're watching this. Like, that's really the emphasis. It's not just on the kind of extreme violence itself that we're watching there. It's on how are people reacting to this? What is this doing for them? Right. And for me, that elevates what could otherwise be a pretty horrific episode that dwells a lot on some pretty fucked up stuff into something that actually has a meaningful point. That this is the essence of it. You may dress it up in, you know, fancy language and strength and honor and the champion of Capua and all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, this is people getting off on watching other people die. And the second that you forget that, you are missing the essence of what this is about.
So, Pat, what you're saying, just to be clear, what we're saying here is when they were coming up with the guy who likes to cut people's faces off and then put the faces on his face, like a particularly horrible sheet mask, like they like to soak it in serum first. Well, this is the thing. Only if they have been keeping up with their 10-step skincare, surely.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be like, so funny, that guy in the bath just with a human face on top of his face.
You don't want some, yeah, you like this is what happens. Like, you're on a plane, you're minding your own business, you look over, there's someone wearing a face.
Yeah, no, that's just Jerry.
That's just, why is he doing that? And he's just looking, and he just like looks over. I'm doing self-care. This is soaked in hydrating serum. Look, I've got my... I've got my special slippers. I've got my tracksuit.
I'm pretty sure it's the human face that he's wearing is less immediately horrifying than some beauty products I've seen.
Okay, yeah, not fair enough. So so what we're saying is when they were coming up with this, like, oh, should we have like a guy and he like cuts off other guys' faces and then he puts them like on his face, and like the people listening are kind of getting more and more kind of like, why does he do that? What's he do that for? And then like the kind of the pitcher who has been like up all night on the bag, coming up with like more and more like kind of hideous ideas. Like, yeah, what then after he's finished cutting off the faces, he makes like a little stack of the faces, like horrible pancakes. And then he puts them on his face, and then he's just got them on his face, and they're like rotting on his face. And like, that probably is like the oldest one is the one that's closest to his face, because that's how stacks work. And then the other person going like, yeah, say more. And then finally he's like, yeah, it's a reference to St. Augustine's City of God.
No, I think what probably happened was that they had the guy, they knew that the guy had fugitivus tattooed on his forehead. Real thing that the Romans did to slaves who escaped or attempted to escape. I think they probably thought, what if you had a guy wearing that? And they worked backwards from there. Nevertheless, the point stands.
Having fugitivus tattooed on your forehead sort of turns you into the Roman Takashi 6'9", doesn't it?
Well, this is something the Romans actually talked about, was that slaves were beaten up and scarred and were often identifiable by things like brands, tattoos, or just the fact that they had been standing around when their owner was in a bad mood and were just kind of a literal punching bag. Slaves were thought to be identifiable on that basis, that you could tell the difference between a free person and a slave because a slave looks like shit. And so that's a real thing. I realize I may have leaned a little hard into the St. Augustine aspect of it when we're trying to justify the face carving. But I think both of those things can be true. I think there probably was somebody in the room who's like, what if we had a guy who cut people's faces off? And then there was somebody else who was like, but this actually helps us get at something. And somewhere in the middle ground between those seemingly diametrically opposed positions, this show has managed to say something interesting about Rome.
I like the idea that the writer's room for this show is the Family Guy sketch about Matt Damon and Ben Affleck writing movies. Have you guys both seen this?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
But this was like a recurring sketch, but it would always just be like Matt Damon just like finishing typing up the screenplay, and then Ben Affleck's like lying on the sofa drinking a beer, and he's like, "Can you put my name on that as well?" And he's like, "Well, have you contributed anything?" And then Ben Affleck just farts, and he's like, "What about that?" And that's like the St. Augustine guy and the "What about a guy who cuts people's faces off" guy.
But you've got the
CGI guy who's like just on acid in the corner.
I love that, but in this case we don't know which one is which. We don't know if it's the Augustine guy who's farting and saying "What about this?" or if it's the face guy who's farting and saying "What about this?" That's the brilliance of this show.
And the showrunner's like summoning over the CGI guy. Why is this bit in space? I was sort of riffing off this guy wearing his sheet mask. And I was just thinking about like how much skincare you'd need to do if you were going into space. And I was just like thinking about that. And then I got to reading St. Augustine and his views on skincare and space. Pretty interesting.
Defensively. They had space then.
They had space.
Space was around.
They didn't go into space, but they had space.
Yeah, they just weren't that interested in going to space.
They weren't like just like rattling around a kind of metal tin, like a kind of, you know, like a tuna. I don't know what I meant by that.
Do tuna rattle in tins?
Yeah.
I always felt like they were pretty closely packed.
If you get
I think that's sardines, you're thinking of.
Get a limited edition ball bearing tuna, that's gonna rattle around.
tuna is loose. Not a combination of words I can ever
just,
say that I've heard
just, need, just to repeat that there, tuna is loose.
Yeah.
It's a loose fish.
Yeah.
It's a loosely packed fish.
It's like a surf
fish.
Brand from the 2000s.
Yeah, it's not a tightly packed fish.
Yeah, no.
It's not got a lot of surface area. It's a kind of, you know, it's a... It's a low molecular integrity fish. Pat, I actually do have a question for you. And this is like a proper question. It's not to do with tin fish, faces, space, St. Augustine, or face tattoos. It's not about any of those things. It's actually about the gladiatorial games as a piece of Roman specificity. Why did they do it? Where did it come from? Does anyone else do it? Is this like, because I always think of it as like very, very specifically Roman, but I know that there were like fighting pits in other civilizations, but like the specifics of the gladiatorial games, like what is that? Where is that? Why? What?
Okay, so that's a fantastic question, because yes, lots of cultures have had fighting for entertainment. Lots of cultures have had different kinds of blood sport, but there is something very specific about what the Romans do with those things, right? So like to combine blood sport and spectator sport and to make the key players in that humans, as opposed to one animal fighting another is the most common thing, like bear baiting or bull baiting, bullfighting. I mean, and obviously you have gladiatorial games are just one part of the Roman games. Mm. And in there, you also have those other things. You have animals fighting each other. You have people fighting animals. You have public executions. The gladiatorial games are just one
trouser
part of that, but they are, what's that?
Trouser ferreting. Dogs running up little ramps and jumping through hoops.
People competitively jumping off faces and then sticking the faces to their own face.
There's not enough killing in that for the Romans. The Romans would absolutely have watched a dog fight a bunch of vermin, and they would have gotten a lot of enjoyment out of that. They would have taken bets on it. Would have been great, like terriers, like ratting terriers in Victorian England, real thing. Mm. You could bet on that. But the gladiatorial games are really specifically Roman. The origins of them, so far as we know, come from the Etruscans, where the Etruscans at funeral celebrations would have pairs of fighters. This shows up in Etruscan tomb art, I think from as early as around the 3rd century BC, maybe the 4th century BC even. There are depictions of paired fighters at what can only be funeral games. Somehow the Romans pick this up, and the Romans, because of the way that games worked for them, the function that games served in Roman society, they were increasingly spectacle, and they were increasingly spectacle that was provided by the wealthy for urban masses. Mm. So rather than being something that happens for a limited audience at a funeral celebration, this is a public festival. This is a gift from a magistrate. And what that gets you is a market for talented fighting in public, right? You have a market in which there is supply, demand, incentives. And the Romans, because this was the way they did things, built systems to meet that demand. The whole institution of the ludus, the idea of a lanista, a trainer of gladiators, is a response to market demand for skilled fighters to perform for a watching public. And how you get from pairs of fighters at funeral games to gladiatorial schools, and this being a fundamental part of kind of Roman public entertainment, how the Romans think of themselves, like, that's a specifically Roman path that gets you from point A to point B. Those conditions didn't exist elsewhere. The enjoyment of blood sport as public spectacle, the economic and cultural incentives to pour quite a lot of money into the field of gladiatorial games, those are specifically Roman things. And it's not a coincidence that gladiatorial games disappear when the market conditions that provided incentives for lanistas to be in business and provide gladiators went away. Like, it's a one-to-one correlation. When those economic and market conditions exist, when there is demand for that, there were people to provide them. When those conditions disappeared, the gladiatorial games disappeared almost overnight. So it's a really straightforward kind of thing that, like, the Romans liked fighting. Mm. They liked people who were good at fighting. They were connoisseurs of violence. And when you have an audience of connoisseurs, you want to provide quality for them.
Yeah.
And I think this is,
you don't want to be giving really them pear cider.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to think about the Roman crowd, like the people who are watching these games, as knowledgeable fans of a thing. Mm. Right. Which sounds
They're
weird
like
to say.
Radiohead guys. That sort of, you know, Retorius Marmillo shit might do it for you, but
I was thinking more like guys who have been to a lot of Phish concerts, like jam band fans. Like they know the difference between people who know what they're doing and people who don't. They know what an entertainer looks like. They have an appreciation. Like, there is a craft that goes into fighting people. Like, you can be skilled at fighting people or not skilled, in the same way that you can be skilled at any other thing. Like, you wouldn't go to a shitty concert and be like, yeah, you know what? Loved it. These guys were great. If you know anything about music, you can tell the difference between a good one and a bad one. Mm. And there were enough people watching these things often enough that they had tastes. Like, they had tastes. They had wanted levels of quality. They wanted certain kinds of fights. And when that's the landscape, when that's the market, and people are literally getting paid money to provide those things, you tend to get a pretty highly developed system to provide them.
Yeah.
And that's the specifically Roman piece of it. It's not the blood sport. It's not the public aspect of it. It's the, we like this stuff and we want to see the good stuff. Which is almost like gladiatorial games at the basic level are bad enough. Mm. Like, the idea of having two people fight sometimes to the death for the entertainment of a crowd is already kind of an objectionable thing, but building this enormous infrastructure of human misery around it. Mm. That's the thing that makes it Roman. Mm. That's the thing that really gets at the heart of the Roman way of doing things.
So the kind of the startup element is what makes it Roman.
Yeah, it's like anybody can have an idea for Facebook, but it takes venture capital in the early 21st century, the emergency of the internet, all that stuff, to make it possible for you to have Facebook as a bajillion-dollar company.
I see.
Right? And that's the same deal here. Like, you, people can play sports, people can fight, people can even fight for money, but to have that be a thing that people are paying attention to and which is well remunerated requires more.
So if you have a monkey who has come up with an idea for how to rate all the other monkeys on monkey campus, mm-hmm. you need some financial infrastructure behind it is what we're saying.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah,
okay. Good. I'm glad.
Yeah, or if you want to watch people
writing this down,
if you want to watch people kill each other, for money, in public and be entertained doing it, then you know that doesn't just happen. You got to build something. We're building something here.
Yeah, yeah. You're sort of like the Dana White of the the Dana Blancus.
Roman Frank Sobotka, is that something?
What if we got guys to fucking slap each other? Roman Frank Sobotka.
So you know Dana White personally hates me, right?
No.
Have we ever discussed that? Like, I was one of his least favorite journalists when I covered mixed martial arts. He has a binder full of printed out news articles from people that he dislikes, and my work was in there quite often, I was told.
Okay, well, first of all, congratulations. Right. Congratulations on your transition, Dana. He's got a binder. I don't know who Dana White is, I'm afraid.
He is the head of the UFC.
Right.
Very bald, very red man.
Yeah.
You would recognize him if you saw him. Always dresses very ominously.
Yeah.
A lot of black suits.
How do you dress ominously? Does he have a face made of other people's faces?
It wouldn't shock me if he did.
I know what some of his pathologies are. As far as I know, that's not one of them. The ones he does have are bad enough.
Okay.
We don't need to
go into it.
Slapping his wife in public at a nightclub on New Year's.
Oh, gross.
Yeah, he's definitely a sex pest.
He's the perfect theoretical allegedly. Opposite of Mitt Romney, because Mitt Romney has binders full of women and Dana White has binders full of what I can only presume are mostly men, if they're UFC journalists that he doesn't like.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, like, that was a formative experience for me as a journalist, because I'm like, yeah, these people are supposed to hate you. They're not supposed to like you. If they like you, you're not doing your job.
Yeah.
Like, otherwise you're doing PR.
Yeah,
and which is fine.
Jester.
Yeah, it's fine to do PR, but you're doing PR. You're not doing journalism. Okay, so leaving Dana White aside, yeah, that guy absolutely existed in ancient Rome, because the conditions for that guy to exist in ancient Rome, existed.
Okay,
that's the specific part about it. It's Rome is not, there are ways in which Rome is a lot like other ancient societies, and there are ways in which it's not. Mm-hmm. The Greeks did not have gladiatorial games like this. The Greeks had other things. The Greeks did have large scale public entertainments. They had athletic competitions.
Yeah,
athletic competitions were a huge deal in the Greek world, much bigger deal in the Greek East than they ever were in the West. Mm.
They had those things. The name will come to me. It's like when like a bunch of people like all get together and then they just like compete in like a kind of games, and it's like every 4 years. That's a whole thing that they did.
Yeah.
I mean, they had the Olympics, they have the Pan-Hellenic Games, they have like there are all sorts of Pan-Greek athletic festivals, plus a whole circuit of lower level local regional festivals that athletes could compete in. You could be a professional athlete in the Greek world. For many centuries, that was a viable profession. Often, like the meathead son of an aristocratic family, that would just be his thing. Like that again, that's a guy who existed.
The GB rower of his day.
Yes, exactly. Or like all the people who do equestrian stuff at the Olympics. Same deal.
Mm.
The Ryan Lochte.
Yeah. This is like these people existed there, but that wasn't a thing in Rome. And the reason why it really wasn't tells you a lot about what made those societies tick.
Hmm.
The Greeks did come to enjoy gladiatorial games to an extent. There are arenas in the eastern half of the empire. There's archaeological evidence for it. Our best preserved cemetery of gladiatorial combatants comes from the Greek world. It comes from Ephesus in Asia Minor, not too far from the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. So it's not like they didn't have it, but they weren't as into it. And also, the games do not seem to have been as violent. The closer you get to what I would call the business end of the Roman world, which would be the frontier and the military, the more violent the games get. So the other place where they've found remains that are undoubtedly those of people who fought in the arena is in York. And there, the crowd seems to have had a penchant for watching decapitations. So the corpses of people who were pretty clearly gladiators who had been involved in the games, like one guy has a hole in his scapula and his shoulder blade that either came from a lion or a tiger. The only way that happens with you being buried in York is if they have imported a lion or a tiger and you're fighting it. But then the guy had his head cut off. So he got bitten by a lion or a tiger and then they cut his head off. Not great.
We've actually talked about this discovery before on the show, because we were talking about like what a tiger would think if it like arrived in ancient York and was just like, what the?
Yeah. Tiger just being like, why is that guy wearing the other guy's face?
This is not what the travel agent told me.
No.
This is not what the pictures in the brochure look like. I'll tell you this for nothing. Oh, they did that. They did that thing. They did that thing where they stand in the doorway of the hotel room and took the picture to make it look much bigger than it was.
The Yorkshire tiger.
This is what you get for buying with points, and not actually purchasing the ticket. So there's variation. There's regional variation. There's local variation. The Roman world is not a unified space, and there are different tastes and practices in different places. I find that really interesting, because I like combat sports. I like fighting. I think it's fun, and I think it's often fun to watch in the right circumstances. So I mean, I'm interested in this at the level of someone who has some experience of things that are not completely unrelated.
Yeah, you're communing with ancient Wymans. You're being like, these are my people.
To an uncomfortable degree, it makes me ask questions about myself. You know what I mean? Where I'm like, the fact that I understand some of what Augustine is talking about here, does that make me a bad person? Mm. And the fact that my answer wasn't immediately no, I had to think about it a little bit.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, but that's the way the Romans approached these things. This is quite early. The Spartacus Blood and Sand is quite early in the history of Roman gladiatorial games, and it's really before the biggest explosion that we see.
Yeah, well, in the case of the first episode of this, the first scene of this episode, before the Big Bang, just him and John Hannah just suspended in space.
Yeah, yeah, goes way back.
Yeah.
But yeah,
John Hannah is a production of The Void.
You could probably sell me on that in some way.
What, like just a show which is just John Hannah just like floating?
Yeah, I'd watch.
Floating John Hannah.
That would be a fun conspiracy theory. Like, you know, just being like, yeah, you know, Germany's not real. Yeah, they just green screen in.
Oh, man. I think there are a lot of people who wish that Germany had been green screened in. Especially in the 20th century, let's say.
Oh yeah.
I just quite like the idea of people in kind of Greece liking gladiatorial games, but sort of treating it almost like a kind of like not especially cool thing that you do like on holiday. They sort of treat it like, oh well, you know, we were there, so we went to a bullfight. It's awful. But you know, you got to. It's the local culture. You got to do it while you're on holiday, aren't you?
It's like Americans in soccer. I think this is actually the way that I would think about it. We're like, pretty cool. Okay. We'll go see Arsenal when we're in London. Yeah, it's neat.
Greek guy getting up at 3 a.m. to watch Colosseum gladiatorial games, you know, wearing his fucking Aventine jersey. And all of his mates are like, oh, fucking bore off, mate. Like, what is this?
Doing his pay-per-view. He's got this incredibly expensive sports package so that he can watch the Panhellenic games.
He's wading into like graffiti on walls when he goes to Rome with his opinions about the side, and everyone's like, fuck off.
I mean,
fucking Helene.
That's a hilarious. That's a hilarious short story waiting to be written. That is, I would 100% write that story. That would be really fucking funny.
You should.
Well, I mean, so we're now four episodes through this show. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think of it? Like, do I sound like an insane person when I try and defend this insanity?
Like, I'm enjoying
Augustine was the first thing I thought of.
I deserve that.
I'm like, the bit from St. Augustine where they're having a conversation about gladiators in space.
I hear it now.
But again, St. Augustine had space. There was space there above them.
That's true. He was holding space.
He was holding space. I have a couple of notes. They're not complaints specifically, but there are a couple of notes. One of them is the dialogue is increasingly slightly Shakespearean, and I don't really know why they're doing that, unless they want to differentiate between the probable spoken language of the minor aristocracy compared to the spoken language of the gladiators, who all speak normally. So, like, I wonder if that's like part of it, but it does. I found it a little bit distracting once I noticed it. The other thing is that they've sort of started using Batiatus and Lucy Lawless as sort of engines of exposition, and they normally do this in, like, they put some kind of like soft porn in to the exposition bits, just in case you're a bit like, this is boring. I don't want to know about the legal specificity of what happens if you annoy a legate but you don't have an heir. I'm gonna need to see a bum of some description while I'm listening to this explanation. Like a little bit of like visual interest, a little bit of eye candy. We didn't have that this episode. We just had them having a conversation. But
it was still very horny though.
It was quite horny.
Extremely.
It was quite horny. And then they're talking about how the fact that they don't have an heir, and this is meaningful in terms of the success of his gladiatorial school. And this has sort of come up. This has like come up a couple of times. It's a little bit tiresome, I think. I understand why it's there, but it's a bit like, can't you just let a conniving slag be a conniving slag? You don't have to. She doesn't have to be a conniving slag who's sad about not having a kid. I think that's unfair to the noble office of the conniving slag. Personally. There's some stuff about
respect the office, not the slag.
Exactly. There's some stuff about her. She's trying to kind of draw. He's not called Globulus. What's his name?
Glabber.
I'm just gonna call him Globulus now because that's what he's called. That's what he's called in my head. She's trying to kind of draw his wife in, and his wife is like is getting like kind of sort of grotty about the gladiators. This happened in the last episode, but there's like more of that. The one thing that I am interested in what you both think about, it's not the one thing I'm interested in, but like this is the one thing that we have not addressed, which is on my notes, which is, what do you think the relationship with the divine is in this show?
It's interesting.
Because the reason I'm bringing it up is that whenever like the gods come up, Spartacus is like, no, that's like stupid. Like, you don't believe that, do you?
Yeah, and he's like a Reddit atheist.
Exactly. And every other time the gods come up, it's either cynical or it's mocking. And we're not seeming to see much of the, well, yeah, like there are gods, and like obviously, like you can't fuck them off. You got to do your little tasks for the gods.
Yeah, yeah, your ablutions.
There's not really much of that. There seems to be, and I think this is a very, very specific late aughts, early tens vibe, which is this idea that the ancient peoples didn't really properly believe in their gods. They're just like something which is around to be used as like a kind of cynical political and social tool. And I think that's something which is maybe a little bit unintentional in the show, but it definitely is the vibe.
Yeah. I think you're 100% right to locate this in the late aughts, early tens, because that's I think that's one of the most dated things about the show. When you said there's a little Reddit atheism to it,
yeah,
I think that's exactly true.
Yeah.
And it's kind of easy to forget now, I would say, how widespread that was at the time. And as, I think especially among the set of people who were making and watching this show, those would have been really, really, really like majority viewpoints at that point in time. I think people treat it with more sensitivity now, but to have really leaned into that, they would have had to have made a really conscious choice to take ancient religiosity seriously.
Yeah.
And because you're right, ancient people, it's not you believe in the gods or you don't. There really is not a strong atheistic tradition in the ancient world. They do exist, but it's not a strong tradition. For the most part, there's a line where Batiata says the gods are shitting on me from a very great height. And that's accurate. If you're an ancient person, you're going through the world, bad things are happening to you. The gods are in fact shitting on you.
Yeah.
That's absolutely correct. But I think what you're pointing to, Phoebe, if I'm not wrong, is that there's a disconnect between the language, which I think mostly accurately reflects how ancient people dealt with the gods. And there's kind of a lack of feeling. There's kind of a lack of buy-in in the way the show approaches it, where like, what are the implications of really believing that? Right. And there's a little bit of inauthenticity in that,
yeah,
in the way that they treat it.
Yeah, I think so.
Because you're right. It's kind of coy. It's kind of winking. It's kind of, they're smarter than that, which on the one hand, yeah, these people are not idiots. Like the ancient Romans were not idiots. Like they were people. They knew how to do things. They had a sense for causality and how the world worked. It's not like these people were not idiots. But this is almost like, well, they can't have believed that. It's like, really?
Yeah.
Well, Pierre once said something very interesting to me about this, talking about the medieval period, but I think it probably holds as well here, where he'd be like, one of his lectures in Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic was always going on about this, like the when you have to like enter the logic of the time. And so like, he'd be like, you know, there'd be an account of like a monastery getting raided by Vikings. And the first thing they would do would be like set up a prayer circle. And then, and then he was like, the classic undergraduate reaction to this would be like, well, that's mental, like do something, lock all the doors or whatever. And he's like, no, but to them, that was like the first logical thing that you did. That was like science, because it's like, that's part of the process of like, that's not like.
That is locking the doors.
Yeah. It's not like a fringe positioned. You're not like the hippie one for being like this. Like that's like on the order of operations sheet. It's like, well, in case of fire, well, the first thing you do is pray, and then you lock the doors, and then you know whatever. And so like, if you genuinely believe that works, then it's not irrational to do it.
And that's true of sacrifice. I think that's a really good way to think about sacrifice in the ancient world too. Is like, you do a thing, you pour out a libation. You do some daily task, you set aside an offering, right? Like that's baked in to the way that people approach the tasks as a whole. It's not an add-on, right? Like and that's an important distinction to make. I love the monastery example, because like to them, we say lock the doors. For them, the prayer circle is locking the doors.
Yeah. Mm.
That is understanding the causality of it, which is that a bad thing is happening. And how do we address the bad thing? We address the ultimate cause of all good and bad things and try to get him on our side. Mm-hmm. That is the door for them. That in their understanding of how the world works, the prayer circle is the first step to making sure that you're safe. It's not like, it's not something that you run to when all other options are exhausted. That's your first thing. If you're a Roman and you're going about your daily life and you're hoping the harvest is good, well, you pour one out for the gods.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do, because that's part of ensuring that the good things happen. There's a tendency to think of these things as separable, right? Like that there's the action and then there's the religious aspect of it that goes along with it, or that you kind of tack on. And that's not the case. The religious aspect is right there in the DNA of the action itself.
Yeah.
and trying to separate those things. If you try and separate those things out, you're missing something really fundamental about their world.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. I like just being hyper-cynical. There's something that feels a bit like, oh, we don't want to find out what Thracians believe, do we? I can't be bothered. No, that sounds like bullshit.
And not in their defense, but is an explanatory thing. We don't know.
Yeah.
That's one of the unfortunate things about the ancient world, is it's really, really, really hard to get inside the minds of everyday people to understand what they thought about the gods and religion in their daily lives. We get lots of hints, but we're always working from the hint or the expression or the practice to try to get at the underlying belief. Mm-hmm. And that is surprisingly difficult. Like, there are a lot of people who have spent their whole lives trying to figure out popular religion, popular religious belief, the relationship between gods and people as understood by the vast majority of people who were living in this time and place. And it is shockingly hard.
Super hard.
Yeah.
It's effectively impossible when we're talking about these kind of fringe cultures, especially ones that weren't especially literate. Like the Thracians had writing, but and we have some Thracian texts. We have Greek texts from Thrace. We don't have a lot that tells us how your average Thracian living out in the countryside is going to understand the numinous landscape that they see around them, which is, we don't know.
Next, we didn't have Instagram comedians then, because now it would be like, you know, your Thracian mum when she catches you smoking a cigarette, and you're like, Ella, you're going to do your homework, because if you don't, the tree god will beat you. Like, you know, you'd have that.
Yeah, so does anybody else's Thracian mum keep a plastic bag full of other plastic bags in the kitchen drawer?
This is the kind, like, no joke. This is the kind of stuff we're missing. Mm-hmm. Like, people, so I love those kinds of videos, and I love seeing them because there's always a reason for it. There's always a logic.
Yeah.
Right. And the logic is always culturally specific to that, to whatever group we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to get a glimpse into that logic unless you start talking about the collection of plastic bags. And every culture has its equivalent of the collection of plastic bags, or mom does this, or dad says this, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those are actually extraordinarily meaningful things. Mm-hmm. I think they are right at the heart of, like, those things are always skeleton keys that help you unlock something really deep and meaningful about a culture. Mm. And one of the sad things about the ancient world is that we often don't have those.
Does anyone else's Thracian mum keep trying to set him up with horsemen? I don't care if he's a skilled horseman, mum. I live in Hackney.
This is the stuff. We don't have this. Like, this is the stuff I want. I want to hear what the Thracian mom was complaining about. Mm. I would like to know about stereotypes of Gaulish dads.
Yeah.
Like, this is stuff I would really like to have for the ancient world. Like, maybe that tells you, like, how my mind works as a historian, but that's the kind of shit I
coming
want.
Coming home to your Thracian dad and uncles in. Fucking hotboxing the wagon. Sorry, Gary.
The Gaulish dad comes in and just, like, stands in front of the effigy with his hands behind his back.
Yeah. Yeah, the Colosseum stood up, hands behind back.
Yeah. Well, because
what are you watching?
What's hilarious to me is, like, we know these things existed because when we have the evidence, we can see them. The Romans had stereotypes about matrons, they had stereotypes about young women, they had stereotypes about Thracians, they had stereotypes about, like, Roman dads, like, there were Roman dad stereotypes. They had these things. We know they existed, which makes it all the sadder when you can't figure out what they were.
Yeah.
I would like to know that.
Oh, yeah. Like,
I'm a bit of a matron when Artur myself.
I think that would be a really good, I think that would be a really good video series, like, trying to come up with some ancient world stereotypes. But in the style of a front-facing comedian.
That would be... Have we found our next season?
Potentially.
Because I think we could do that.
I think we could do that.
A Roman, female guy.
Yeah. Like
that's Ovid. That's just Ovid.
That's literally just Ovid. Yeah. I remember this, like when there was like a few years ago, there was this new translation of the Ars Amatoria, and all of the reviews like said like the same thing, which was like, isn't it like incredible? Isn't it so like cool and so interesting, like how this could have been written today? And I'm like, you think that's interesting? I think that's depressing. I think that's depressing as shit that it could be written today. That's bleak that it could be written today.
It's bad.
The attitudes of 2,000 years ago could easily transplant to three guys sitting on a sofa doing a lifestyle podcast. That is to me fucking bleak.
Dudes have always been about getting pussy.
There has always been a hot couch.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And there has always been a hot couch. And there have always been people sitting on the hot couch.
Oh, it's hot couch. There you go. There's a series title for you. It's hot couch. Mm,
yeah. An insufferable one.
Yeah, where it would have been a podcast. Catullus is like fucking, you know, Hinge soft boy. Do you like the National?
There aren't really soft boys on Hinge. I think Catullus is more a field guy.
Yeah. He's on campus.
My favorite piece of academic writing I ever did was on Catullus, and it was on one of his invective poems. It's the one where he says he's going to throat fuck the guy who's been talking about him.
Yeah.
So what
you
I did,
imagine the guy reading it just being like,
Catullus 16. Yeah.
What do you mean you're going to, why are you going to do that?
That's weird, mate.
That's really weird of you, man.
One of the very few, I think there's only maybe one other like literary reference to the verb irumatio in the entire corpus of Latin literature. It's Catullus 16 and then whatever. And then whatever the other one is. And he uses it like 17 times.
I love the idea of someone reading being like, okay, so this word here, like, is this like, what is this? Is this like your slang? And Catullus being like, yeah. I've come up with a new participle.
That was my experience reading the poem in grad school. I'm like, huh, I wonder what this means.
Oh.
And I asked my Latin tutor at the time, and he's like, I just didn't know what to do with it and kind of moved on. And so then I wrote a paper about it. I wrote a paper about the poem. And what I found is because there's in the way that these poems function at a metrical level, there's the meter of the poem itself, but then there's also the natural stress of the words and how they fall. So I tried to compare the natural stress of the poem, like how the words land, with where he puts the invective, like where he puts the actual really fucked up words in the poem. And every single time, this is the craft of Catullus, this is why he's so good, the natural stress lands on the throat fucking verb or whatever the other awful thing is. So like, he clearly knew what he was doing. Like the craft involved in making that poem, pretty extraordinary.
Because you will be feeling stressed when I'm throat
fucking. Can't say he was a good.
Exactly.
Oh my.
And I'm like, wow, he really got it. But that's my favorite piece of academic writing I ever did.
I just really like the idea of like, of that guy's like friends being in like Roman group chat, being like, okay, you know what? We weren't sure whether or not we were going to show this to you, but Catullus has written a poem about you. Has he? What's it say?
It's on his close friend's story.
You don't want to know what it says. All right. Well, you know, screenshots for the blocked, eh? Okay. He said he's going to do what? Why did he say that? I don't understand why you would say
I've never
that.
Even heard that before.
What is that? Yeah, it's like,
no,
he
only
come
one
up
other
with
guy's
a new
ever
word?
Said it.
Has he come up with a new word? He has. He's using his weird Catullus slang.
Squaring up to a guy outside the taverna and being like, I'm going to fuck you, bro.
I'm going to fuck you in the mouth.
Yeah.
And then being like, what?
I'm going to come in your ass, bro.
What do you mean?
Sorry, what?
Speaking of which, did you guys see, I think it was a tweet from several days ago talking about the Trump Elon fight that's going on at this particular moment? Are you guys like, you've just never seen two alphas jousting before, right? Like this is what high masculinity men, it looks like when they're fighting.
Oh, wow.
And, like that's the gayest shit anybody has ever said.
Yeah, that's incredibly gay.
Which is amazing when you've got access to everything Donald Trump has ever said, which is quite a gay corpus.
That's what I'm saying, right? Like this is, it's hardly out of keeping with the overall thrust, so to speak.
Oy.
But yeah, I just thinking about that. I'm like, man, yeah. Gender. It's a real thing.
It is. Wow. You know,
there are at least
three, as Joe Biden once said. So this has been a Patreon one. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Master of Our Domain podcast. As a premium hog, you are the people who keep this shit going. So thank you very much for your continued financial support of the show. It enables us to do things like invent the Ovid podcast. Ovid's
hot couch. Hot Roman couch.
That's right. Fucking hell, the Triclinium podcast. It's just three dudes lying down. Yeah, the slave girl comes in with Doritos.
They have to keep leaving the room to go and be sick in another room, and then they come back.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
Cool Ranch Doritos.
Yeah. Frigidas. Willar Frigida. Yeah. Anyway, right. Thank you. We will see you next week on the free feed. Please come and see me in Bristol, if in Bristol, on the 14th. That'd be great. And Refugee Action in London on the 19th. This is June, both June. All right. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.